defend Israel, but not irrational policies that will lead to war for both of us. Trying to discredit Kissinger, Israeli lobbyists have even used this line to try to discredit Mr. Kissinger, himself a Jew. They have contended that he was tough on Israel because he was ashamed of his own background and wanted to ingratiate himself with the non-Jewish establishment. But if some eloquent speeches by Mr. Kissinger about his heritage are any measure, this charge hasn't any foundation, emphasis supplied. It is difficult to believe that more than 10 years have passed since the Wall Street Journal article was written, but the potent persuaders are, if anything, more potent today. The power and influence of the Israeli lobby is as broadly based under the leadership of Yitzhak Shamir as under Menachem Begin. Jews in political activism. To understand the Israeli lobby and its various levels of activity, it is first necessary to have some idea of the relationship of the American Jewish community to our political system and the nature and extent of its involvement in the political process. An excellent work on this subject is a book entitled Jews and American Politics by Stephen Isaacs, which is the source of much of the information on the subject presented in the next several pages of this chapter. The Jewish people wield political power in America far beyond their numbers. Historically, this power has been used to a large extent in support of liberal causes and the Democratic Party, and has been in the highest tradition of American democracy. Indeed, it should be emphasized that, in the past, Jewish participation in American political life has redounded greatly to the benefit of our nation. As a general rule, Jews in the past have been reluctant to run for political office, and, as a result, there have been relatively few Jews in the Congress or in the governorships. The reasons, according to Isaacs, are twofold. 1. They have perhaps underestimated the willingness of the people to elect a Jew to high office, and 2. They prefer to avoid the high visibility of public office and would rather exert their influence behind the scenes. While this attitude is beginning to change, and more Jews are now running for office, particularly at the state and local levels, the strong preference is still to be kingmaker rather than king. Jewish political power and influence derive from a number of sources, one of which, but not necessarily the most important, is money. Jews normally donate more than half the large gifts to national democratic campaigns. Although they are less of a financial factor in the Republican Party, they are, nevertheless, of considerable significance. Another and perhaps equally important source is political activism. Jewish political activism is found at all levels, from the ballot box to the highest councils of government and politics. It is estimated that Jews now comprise between 10% and 20% of those actively involved in the Democratic side of American politics. They were prominent in the top management entourage of nearly all of the principal Democratic presidential contenders in 1972. Edmund S. Muskie was managed by Beryl I. Bernhardt, Henry S. Jackson had Ben J. Wartenberg, Hubert Humphrey used Maximum Campbellman, George McGovern had Frank Mankiewicz. Of the Richard Nixon political enemies list, released by the Senate Watergate Committee, 7 out of the first 8, and a total of 12 out of the first 20 were Jewish. Of the 3 principal national public opinion surveys, 2, Louis Harris and Daniel Yankelevich, are Jewish. Pollsters have discovered that an extraordinarily high percentage of people who ask to do their interviewing are Jewish. One of the nation's most prominent political reporters, David S. Broder, is Jewish, as was the late Theodore White, our most popular political historian and author of The Making of the President. There have been innumerable Jewish speech writers for virtually all candidates and presidents, including the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Robert Strauss. It is a fact that Jews are simply more active and interested in politics than their fellow Americans. Nearly 4 times as many Jews as non-Jews protested American Vietnam military policy. Another source of power is the media. The major television networks were founded by David Sarnoff, William S. Pally, and Leonard Goldenson. These organizations are heavily Jewish, as are their reportorial staffs. The fact that no network anchorman is Jewish is explained by Isaacs as an effort to avoid the appearance to the viewing public of being too Jewish. Jews could be the backroom presidents of the network news divisions, while the non-Jewish anchorman could project a comforting WASP image to an overwhelmingly WASP audience. The newspaper industry, as such, is neither owned nor controlled by Jewish interests. However, the newspapers in which Jews occupy senior editorial positions are especially influential in national politics. These include the New York Times, Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and New York Post. The late Walter Lippmann, perhaps the greatest of modern political journalists, was Jewish, as were Arthur Kroc and David Lawrence. These have been succeeded today by such prominent and capable political journalists as Joseph Kraft, Maximum Lerner, and William Safire. A further and very effective source of political power is the presence of Jews in the government itself. While the number of Jewish office holders, at the national level, do not exceed the relative proportion of Jews to the general population, the number of Jews in staff positions in Congress, and in many of the federal administrative agencies far exceeds their proportionate representation in the population. Many of these are key positions which can be, and are, effectively used to accomplish specific objectives. An example of such objectives is the amendment to force the Soviet Union to ease restrictions on the emigration of Soviet Jews, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. This was devised and drafted by Jewish activist senatorial staffers. The same holds true of the Arab boycott legislation. One staffer is quoted as saying that a certain Jewish senator, who cares deeply about Jewish affairs, has enough seniority now to place some 60 of his people in key committee jobs around the Senate. Why this effort to place activist Jews in key positions is important, according to the same Jewish staffer, is that there are only 6 million of us, Jews, and 200 million of them. How the US Jewish minority manages to get things done, according to the staffer, is explained by the fact that senators have a million things to do and generally take the recommendations of their administrative assistants. If the senator does not cooperate, the next step is to call for outside help, which means direct pressure on the senators from their Jewish constituents. In this way, according to Stephen Isaacs, the apparatus is able to generate a flood of letters to Congress or the president, or to deluge the editorial offices of the nation's newspapers with letters to the editor giving the impression of overwhelming popular support for or against any given measure. Another Senate staffer says, "What you have in this country is a fantastic untapped reservoir of Jews who are in influential positions, relatively wealthy, well-educated, professional, politically active, who when organized, can get the support of three-quarters of the Senate." In an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, entitled "The Hired Hands, the Power of These Congressional Staffers" is discussed. A few years ago, people who worried about making government accountable for its actions used to point to the federal bureaucracy as the major obstacle standing between hapless citizens and the elected officials they're supposed to control. These days, as Congress takes an increasingly active role in setting national policy, observers are shifting their attention and concern to another group of unelected decision-makers, congressional staffs. In two recent articles in The Public Interest, Michael J. Malbin and Michael Andrew Scully have described the growing power of these staffs and the special problems that arise from this power. Even more important than the growth in staff numbers has been the kind of jobs they have come to do for their congressmen. Mr. Scully points out that today staffers not only set the agenda for our legislation and organize the hearings and negotiations that shape it, but actually draft the laws themselves and write the reports of legislative intent that accompany them. And when they do all these things, the staffers are not just mirroring the congressional will. For one thing, their very numbers and levels of activity change the shape of the lawmaking process. Instead of merely carrying out a legislative program, they also help create one, inventing things to do where there were none before. For another, they are highly partisan. They tend to seek not dispassionate knowledge, but the knowledge that brings advantage. And to add to these problems that Mr. Malbin and Mr. Scully describe, Too many of these staffers seem to have been schooled to the assumption that the private sector may best be thought of as an insidious disease